From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Dave Iverson. Assembly Bill 5, legislation on the process for evaluating public school teachers, stirred up quite a bit of controversy in Sacramento this week. Fierce opposition in some quarters, along with last-minute amendments tacked on before today's expected final vote, led to the bill being shelved. But the debate AB 5 sparked about how to best evaluate teacher performance is not going away. And in the coming hour of Forum, we look at the system as it stands today, what changes might improve it, and what it was about AB 5 that proved to be such a lightning rod for the opposition. Stay with us for all that. It's coming your way after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Dave Iverson. State lawmakers were all set to vote on a controversial bill today in Sacramento, one that tackled the issue of teacher evaluations. Assembly Bill 5 would have changed a system for measuring a teacher's job performance that's been in place for about 40 years. But fierce opposition to the bill on some fronts, coupled with last-minute amendments that would have not had the benefit of time for debate, led sponsor Felipe Fuentes to shelve the bill for this session at least. And whether it will be resurrected later isn't known, since Fuentes is termed out. But this whole question of how to evaluate our state's public school teachers doesn't go away. What factors are most given weight in these assessments? Is it test scores, seniority, graduation rates, and who sets the criterion? It's a conversation we want to address today on Forum. With us for the discussion is a panel of guests, but first we want to check in with Eric Hines. He's the vice president of the California Teachers Association, a union in favor of the stalled legislation, and he joins us by phone this morning to check in. Good morning, Eric Hines.
Yes, good morning.
So are you disappointed?
Yes, very disappointed. You know, we believe very strongly, teachers around the state, that the purpose of evaluations really should be to improve their knowledge and skills and improve our instructional practices, so thereby raising student achievement. And we believe that AB 5 was taking a very good step in that direction. It's a shame that with this being pulled, that we now go back to a system that just doesn't do that, that hasn't worked for us for a long time. And if you talk to many teachers around the state, it hasn't worked. And this would have been a great way for California to again lead and reprofessionalize the profession and reprofessionalize teacher evaluation.
Sure. Pull back the curtain a little bit on what happened last night, if you would. We haven't heard comment yet from the teachers' unions on the matter. What were you there and what happened?
Well, I wasn't there. I was kind of hearing from what was going on. I know there were a lot of amendments that were proposed at the last minute, some even eliminating collective bargaining from the process, just a lot of bad amendments. And I think that probably, I don't know, and I don't want to argue intent because I wasn't there, but that had the ultimate effect of having the bill pulled.
Which, or was there one particular amendment that you're aware of, or a certain factor that was the killing point, the tipping point?
No, I think you'd have to ask the Fuentes about that. I mean, it's I wasn't there.
What was it about AB 5 that the unions were most excited about seeing? What kind of change?
Well, what it did was it provided teachers with the kind of feedback that would be necessary to help make their improve their practice. I mean, it focused on the California Standards for the Teaching Profession, which many districts already use, but not all. It would have actually increased the frequency of evaluations for many permanent teachers, and it provided a lot of multiple measures, including student test scores, as long as they were valid and reliable for that purpose, and a lot of other multiple measures. It really focused on peer collaboration, and it also allowed local districts, which are like local little, you know, communities, each and of themselves, that have very different needs, to collectively bargain things that would meet their own needs. For example, what would be, you know, what might work for Los Angeles won't work for either San Francisco or, you know, in the East Bay or some smaller district or even up in Weed, California.
You know, it's no secret that the teachers' unions, you know, it's a big force to be reckoned with, and it gets a lot of press in both directions. And I'm wondering if you think that the collective bargaining issue on the table was the factor that put so many people off.
Well, you know, there is a lot of opposition to that, but we've been collective bargaining evaluation. It's in the Spell Act currently. And what collective bargaining really is put the voice of those actually being evaluated into designing the evaluation process. And that makes perfect sense because what we do is a very, you know, it's a very complicated job. It's not simple, and it seems to make sense that a teacher has some say in how the process is built and some classes, and it involves all the stakeholders. It had hearings that would allow parents and students to have input into the process. I think there were actually two hearings in the bill currently. It would have allowed anything that was currently bargained to stay in place until that contract was reopened. It basically just gave all the stakeholders a say in what was going on, and that means it would build a better process that everybody had buy-in to.
And do you know why it was decided right at that last hour to pull the legislation? Obviously, they knew they were up against the wire.
Well, you know, according to Assemblymember Fuentes, you know, you said there were just too many bills that didn't have time for, and I think you said it in the beginning as well, that wouldn't have time for proper vetting.
Too many amendments. Too many amendments.
Amendments. I'm sorry. I meant amendments. And it's a shame that it's a disappointment. It's a disappointment that we now have to wait some more time.
Well, that's what I want to ask you one more thing before we let you go. Where do you go from here? So if Assemblyman Fuentes is termed out, what does that mean for this particular piece of legislation? And with you and the California Teachers Association, how do you take the issue up moving forward?
Well, when we're talking, you know, about you know, the union and so on, we're really talking about the 325 members that we represent around California. So we're talking about the teachers who are in the classroom, and this is a very important issue to us for obvious reasons. It's important to us because we want to improve our practice. We think that what's working has been used as a, you know, kind of a drive-by gotcha kind of way. It's been used in just a very cursory way that doesn't promote any improvement in our practice, and that's
right,
what we want.
But going forward, how will you jump on the next session? How will you move forward with it?
Well, I think we'll try to find someone else that has the courage, like Assemblyman Fuentes, to stand strong and do what's right for the students of the state.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Sure, I appreciate that. Thank you.
That's Eric Hines. He's the vice president of the California Teachers Association. Well, for the rest of the hour, we've got a lot of conversation to have about teacher evaluation in general, in the broader scope. AB 5 is a great springboard, but the larger issue is ongoing year in, year out. And with us for the conversation, we've got a great panel. Jill Tucker is with us. She's an education writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also with us is Gary Ravani, and he's vice president with the California Federation of Teachers. He's also been a classroom teacher for 35 years, so has a lot of years behind him, actually on the front lines. Good morning, Gary Ravani.
Morning. Glad to be with you.
And Tim Melton also joins us. He's the Vice President of Legislative Affairs with the organization Students First, which is a bipartisan grassroots organization that focuses on education and reform. Well, Jill Tucker, I want to go to you first. And if you would, let's step back a little bit and get a clear picture of what the current teacher evaluation system that's been in place for about 40 years or so, what that system looks like.
Great. I want to start by saying I love this topic because it's very controversial. It's something that everyone cares about. Whether you were ever a student, which most of us were, in a classroom and you had good teachers and bad teachers, or whether you're a parent now, you know, I equate teachers to a certain degree a little like the old adage of pornography, right? You know a bad teacher when you see one. All the teachers in the schools kind of know it. Parents know it. Kids know it. But the question is, how do you officially identify it? And then what do you do when a teacher perhaps is not suitable for the profession or, as Eric said, requires some help, some training, some assistance, some guidance? Currently, the state has a law called the STULL Act, STULL. It's been on the books for a long time. A lot of people generally say it's largely ignored. Teachers do get evaluated. They get evaluated about every 5 years under the Act. It's a pass-fail system based often on a, as Eric said, a drive-by evaluation by the principal where they see the they walk in and see the teacher.
So that's so at point number one, when you say they get evaluated every 5 years or so, that's by the principal at the time at that school.
Correct. And usually it's a classroom observation, a pass-fail system, and very few teachers fail. 1 to 2%, depends on the district, depends on the principal.
And but, no student input, no parent input. It's and also, does the teacher know that the principal is going to be in evaluating?
Typically so. Good principals, and there's a lot of good principals, they're in the classrooms all the time. They're watching teachers, they're helping them, they're guiding them. But the official evaluation is something that's a little different, where they go in and it's actually the documentation of that process. Doesn't mean that's the only time the principal's in the room, or in many cases a struggling teacher will have senior mentoring teachers helping them. So it doesn't mean that all of that stuff isn't happening. It just means under this official capacity, when you are officially giving them that work evaluation that we all get from our bosses, it's a very official process that is directed by the STOLL Act. Many districts, or some districts, actually have gone beyond that. They have negotiated with their unions to enhance the STOLL Act. San Francisco is among them, where they incorporated a more rigorous teacher evaluation system and training system for those struggling when they passed a parcel tax. So teachers got a lot more money from the parcel tax, a big raise, but they also had this system to identify and help teachers that were struggling. And so in San Francisco, it's not just a pass-fail. They have different categories. If they are unsatisfactory, they have to go into a training program. If they're still unsatisfactory, they either counsel the teacher to leave or they start dismissal proceedings.
Okay. And when this principal is doing this evaluation, what external data is incorporated into it? So are test scores, grad rates, evaluations, any hard data enters in and according to this STOLL Act?
According to the STOLL Act, yes. According to reality, maybe, maybe not. So, for example, in Los Angeles, they were sued for not adhering to the STOLL Act, specifically in terms of the area of using student performance, student achievement as part of the teacher evaluation. And basically, Los Angeles is now in the process under court order to include student data, specifically test scores, in the process of evaluating teachers. That is something that the union has very, very strongly opposed, and one of the reasons why they were strongly supporting AB 5.
And this is all pretty recent history. This court order that came down with
last
the LA
year.
Unified was, I think, just even a few months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting. I don't know that there's a link, but the flurry around AB 5 happening so quickly right now may or may not have been linked to that. And we'll get to that during the course of things. But So right now, what you're saying in the current system, there is this act where test scores are considered teacher observation by the principal. There's a whole construct, and it happens every 5 years or so. And there's no parent and no student input, as far as you know.
Typically not, but that doesn't mean that there isn't some of that. Obviously, a principal who's gotten complaints of a teacher is going to be incorporating that, but it's not as if parents are sitting in the classroom with a pen doing the observation.
Okay, so Tim Melton, I want to bring you into the conversation. You're with Students First, and that's an organization that's very committed to education process reform. What do you say when you hear that process? What do you think, and what could be improved upon?
Well, we talk about the STOLL Act, and instead of, or AB 5 even, and we talk about what's in it. I think we should talk about what's not in it. You know, the President of the United States and Secretary Duncan have been very clear that they want the definition of performance to be significant in the evaluation. That was purposely excluded in AB 5, and I think that's one reason why it wasn't going to get the votes, because a lot of discussion on AB 5 was that this is going to allow California to be granted a waiver under No Child Left Behind and would free up hundreds of millions of dollars.
And what constitutes significant improvement?
That's a good question. My wife would say 1%, because if you win an election by 1%, that's significant. Other people would say 51%, So I think that's where the word significant would have to be defined. I mean, we would like to see the percentage higher, and other states have went with a higher percentage, and the unions have supported it. I mean, just this year in Cleveland, the Cleveland mayor, Mayor Jackson, who's a Democrat, passed a bill through the Ohio legislature that demanded 50% student growth, annual evaluation in four tiers, and the AFT in Cleveland supported it. This year in Connecticut, Democratic Governor Malloy passed a reform bill that caused 40% of the evaluation they thought was significant. That was supported by the unions there as well. And even in Pennsylvania this year, they had over 30% student growth, multiple measures, four tiers of effectiveness. And we had Democratic legislative champions, and the teacher unions there supported and were neutral.
You know,
I just want to say that definition can get foggy, but at least put the word significant in the bill. It was excluded purposely, and the feds have said for every state that's been granted a waiver under ESEA, the word significant has been in there, or they've defined what significant is.
So this issue will no doubt be resurrected in one form or another. What beyond this term significant, which was left out, what was most objectionable to you in AB 5 that you would take issue with if it was to be resurrected in another form?
I mean, not having annual evaluations, I don't think makes sense to anybody in the state of California.
So everybody, you call for annual ones, not...
They don't. They call for 3 years. We call for annual.
You call for annual.
Well, because, I mean, everybody that has a job in the state is evaluated annually. I mean, to say you're going to be evaluated every 3 years, there are three classes of kids that are going to go through that classroom without a formal evaluation done, knowing, is that teacher having an impact?
Is that possible financially for school
Absolutely.
Districts?
Absolutely. Other states have done it. Matter of fact, the majority of states now in the country have moved to annual evaluations. So other states are doing it. I'll say this. 41 years ago, when the STALL Act was enacted, California was trailblazing when it came to evaluations. It took parents to stand up and say, look, you're not even adhering to the laws on your own books. They went to the local district, and the district said, we agree. And then all of a sudden had to go to a court case. So I'm going to say 41 years later, it took parents and teachers standing up at the state capitol last night and over the last several weeks, calling thousands of calls, emails, visits to legislators to stop AB 5, which was a railroad job at the last minute. And we all knew it. Every major editorial board in the entire state editorialized against AB 5. And the only reason it was resurrected is because it would nullify and abolish the STALL Act that the courts upheld just, you know, a month ago.
All right. That's Tim Melton speaking with us. He's with Students First, and that's a bipartisan grassroots organization that is working with education reform. Also with us this hour, Jill Tucker, an education writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, and Gary Ravani, who we'll hear from shortly. He's vice president of the California Federation of Teachers. And if you'd like to join in this hot topic conversation, go ahead and give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. Well, Gary Ravani, why don't you weigh in? You're representing another union, and just heard Tim Melton speak about annual evaluations as being important, and the language of significant being left out. How would you respond to that?
Well, for one thing, I'd like to point out that evaluations, of course, would be carried out, at least in the summative form, by administration. And California has about the fewest administrators per student of any of the 50 states. If we're talking about getting away from mere drive-bys, then we're talking about a rather intense effort to put in, you know, several hours or so into the evaluation process, and flatly we don't have enough administrators to be able to carry that out. So in order to increase the number of administrators or to increase some other core of trained evaluators to do this would entail some cost.
Did AB 5 include unfunded mandates as well, though?
Well, AB 5 said that there was going to be basically a pilot program, as the Assemblyman Fuentes put it, that would begin with our higher need schools called the QEIA schools, and they would get some funding to begin that process, and then it would be a matter of school districts, that would be management and teachers sitting down together at the bargaining table and talking about how do we need to allocate resources in our district so that we can best carry out this new kind of evaluation process. So that's one issue. The other issue is about significant. That's a real problem there, because we have considerable data. For example, the highest scientific body in the nation, the National Research Council, has taken a look at what's gone on the last 10 years in this country since the imposition of No Child Left Behind, and using high-stakes tests to evaluate schools. And, of course, now the idea is to evaluate teachers. And they've said, one, it has not increased student learning, and two, it's had a terribly narrowing effect on the curriculum. Schools, of course, are now ignoring art, ignoring music, ignoring science, of all things, ignoring history, ignoring government and our democratic processes, all so that kids can sit down and drill and drill and drill on tests, so that the more you attach high stakes to tests for kids or to teachers and to schools, the worse the effect has been.
Well, let me jump in here, because let me ask you if the unions in general are opposing the use of any external measurements. I mean, where do test scores fit in your best case scenario for teacher evaluation? We'll stay away from the whole topic of school evaluations, but for teacher evaluations.
Well, the term was being used multiple measures, and that is that test scores were certainly one of a number of different artifacts that teachers and administrators could sit down and take a look at and see where that information, that data might point instruction ought to go. So that's one thing. But again, attaching a given percentage that test scores would amount to in terms of a teacher's evaluation and rating, that's exactly the kind of thing the National Research Council said should not occur. So we don't have anything against tests. The tests are there. And they can be used as well as they can be used. And, of course, it's up to the teachers and the administrators at each site to decide just what that means.
And Tim Melton, we're going to lose you at the bottom of the hour. I want to ask you, before you go, in your ideal view, how should teachers' performance be measured?
Well, let's just say the number one job of a teacher is to make sure that children are learning in their classroom, period. Let's create a system collaboratively that does that. I find it alarming that the unions in California are not aligned with the other 49 states, because unions have supported the use of multiple measures and test scores in evaluations with the word significant in the legislation, and with annual evaluations and using multiple tiers to, I mean, right now you have a binary system, satisfactory, unsatisfactory. The great teachers in the state don't even get recognized. Let's recognize the great teachers. Let's pay those teachers more. And let's use these evaluations that identify effective teachers for all personnel decisions. I mean, other states have said, look, and we're going to, if the most important in-school factor is an effective teacher, let's figure out who those effective teachers are. And if you're not using some type of assessment, a test score, to figure is the child learning from A to B, what are you going to use? And that's what confuses me at this conversation, is that the national unions have embraced this. 80% of Californians in polls, after poll after poll, support this. And that's why the weight of the state of California bore down on the legislature over the last week, when we didn't even get to see amendments. I mean, so many tactics going on to push this bill through that finally the residents of California woke up and said, hey, look,
this is
ridiculous.
And it got shelved. Well, that's Tim Melton speaking with us. He's with Students First, and he has to go at this point, but we thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Also with us this hour talking about evaluating teachers in our public school system is Jill Tucker with the San Francisco Chronicle and Gary Ravani, Vice President of the California Federation of Teachers. And we'll be joined later in the show by Jill Wins. Looking for your calls as well. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You're listening to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Dave Iverson. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson sitting in for Dave Iverson, and we're talking this hour about the process for evaluating teachers in our public school system. There was a Sacramento cat fight that went on last night. I shouldn't say that, but there was a very controversial bill, Assembly Bill Number 5, that was battling it out, and it was going to take on a new approach to evaluating teachers, and it ultimately was shelved late last night when it was clear that the amendments that were being attached to it were not going to have a chance to be debated in good time. So using that as a springboard, we're talking about evaluating teachers on a larger scale. With us for the hour, Jill Tucker. She's a writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, and Gary Ravani is with the Vice President for the California Federation of Teachers. We've also got Jill Wins joining us, and she's the President of the California School Boards Association, also a former commissioner with the San Francisco Board of Education. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here. Not former, still a commissioner, a member of the San Francisco Board of Education.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, so what was your take on this whole, you know, the raising of the issue again and the killing of the issue, at least for now? And where do you come down on all of this?
Well, CSBA opposed AB 5. We are not at all opposed to taking up this issue. Actually, I think we have two main issues. One is that the way this happened, so legislative proposals that sit there are stuck for months and months and months and then come up in the last frantic days of the session. And this is a major reform. This is a, to use that word, significant and important potential change to the public education system in California. And this is just not the way to do this. We absolutely oppose jamming something through at the end of the session. We think it's something that we and the unions and the parent representatives and everybody needs to sit down and talk about what would be the best way to do this. As you heard Jill Tucker mention, in our district, we actually have a robust evaluation system, but I would never agree that anything should be imposed on everyone without input from all the stakeholders and groups that really have to do this.
Well, that's been going on, hasn't it? I mean, this discussion is not new.
This discussion has been set aside as part of the legislative process and then jerked into the center of the legislative process at the very end of the session. But I want to tell you on substance that for school boards, the most important change here is to impose on all school districts the need to negotiate the criteria on which teachers would be evaluated. And anything that expands the things that we are required to bargain rather than say you can bargain these things is so important to us and so difficult for many school districts that that's why it can't be done in this hurried end of session, immediate kind of way.
Jill Tucker, you're nodding your head.
Well, I've covered a lot of school district bargaining processes and, you know, where they just butt heads throughout, have to go to impasse, have to go to mediation, threatened strikes. And I think Jill Wins is right. If, you know, anything you add to that that is controversial is going to drag that process out and be part of a bargaining tool when it comes to wages or conditions or all these things. So instead of looking at it separately as something that needs to be pounded out so that it's in the best interest of kids, it becomes a bargaining chip.
All right, let's go to our phone calls. We've got several folks on the line, and joining us first is Grace from Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. So I just want to mention that I am a former teacher. I live in Los Angeles, and you know, the way that the union is championing complacency, like, that does not work for me. When I was in the classroom, I felt like the union was never actually really speaking for me because I was kicking butt for my kids every day. So my question is, why doesn't California try and be the best again? Like, why don't we adopt the best practices on evaluation standards that are actually being pushed by Duncan and the Obama administration?
Gary Ravani, why don't you weigh in on that?
Okay, because I think if we thought those were the best options, we would champion them. But let me mention again, I talked about the National Research Council and what it said about test-driven evaluation. Let me add that the Educational Testing Service, that happens to be California's state testing vendor, they have said the same thing as the National Research Council. The RAND Corporation has also said that that's not best practice. There's a significant research base on what constitutes quality teacher evaluation. I should add that Tom Torlakson, the superintendent of public instruction in California, convened a group called the Educator Excellence Task Force about a year ago. And there have been a series of meetings with stakeholders from, you know, every possible representative body in the state, including the School Boards Association, participating in that, and working on a variety of different models, one of which would be evaluation. And it's going to be looking at performance-based evaluations, which would have been allowed under AB 5, and that is looking at multiple measures, having trained evaluators to do them, providing enough time, providing what we call peer assistance and review, and that is once the evaluation reveals something, where do you go then?
Right.
You need to have a core of trained mentors to work with teachers to improve their instruction if that's what needs to happen. So all of that needed to be put in place. California had a peer assistance and review program in place a couple of years ago and then defunded it. So that wasn't sound practice. But to suggest the unions are against good practice just because they're not particularly in agreement with what the Obama administration seems to be calling for is a stretch. Other issue is California is currently engaged in discussions with the Obama administration about getting a waiver of No Child Left Behind. And in fact, the representative of Tom Torlakson said that the AB 5 would have actually helped in that pursuit. So,
all right, that's Gary Ravani, Vice President at the California Federation of Teachers. A couple of emails here. This one from Maureen says, your guest said that parents and kids know a bad teacher when they see one. Then she said the principal does evaluations every 5 years. Why aren't the parents and kids giving evaluations, and why do evaluations only happen every 5 years? Jill Wins, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. First, I just want to say that those things that Gary referred to are actually allowed under the law now, and that's what we have in San Francisco, a peer assistance and review program and resources to support that, et cetera. So there isn't any – this law, we wouldn't have needed this law to allow that. We do, however, need the resources. So the issue about student and parent input is essentially, for most districts, that's something which is discussed with the unions in collective bargaining. It's a taking input from teachers and students, from parents and students is perfectly allowable, and we in most districts do that too. We do it by through surveys. We do it through other formal and informal kind of feedback opportunities, and that's important to do. However, the difference, which is easy to just say, oh, let's just have parents and teachers participate in this, is that it isn't appropriate for them to participate in the evaluation, which is something that affects the employment of the teacher. So, there's nothing wrong and there's everything right with the principal, and it's not always the principal, assistant principal, other evaluators,
right,
administrators who do the evaluation, taking into consideration the interaction of that teacher with students. For one thing, remember, classroom observations basically observe the interaction of the teacher and the students, and the students' participation in that too. Second, the frequency is usually the subject of both bargaining and in the law. So should we have more frequent evaluations? I think in some cases we should. Do we have the resources? And I appreciate the mention of the small number of administrators we have, especially by a representative of the teachers union, because that's
sure.
The main issue.
Right. Let's go to some web comments. Christy writes in, once again, you're discussing crucial issues about education, in this case, teacher evaluations, on a school day when, teachers are in school. So you have no input from teachers on the issue. This has been a huge issue for decades. Others discussing and deciding what's good for teachers is what good teaching is and is not, without any respect or regard for teachers themselves. Not only do you not have a teacher as a guest, teachers cannot call in with their input. And we appreciate that comment, Christy. We would note that we do have two teacher union representatives in the course of the hour and teachers on the calls, but I appreciate your input there. Another web comment says, you've got to be kidding. My partner is a data evaluator in a large district locally. All aspects of instituting accountability systems are developed around classroom teachers' needs and desires. And similarly, the failure of these simple accountability systems succeed or fail based on classroom teachers' compliance. As a parent, I spent 20 years directly in the classroom and serving governance compliance committees. The constant complaint suggesting teachers are not being heard or considered is false. And finally, a comment from Anita. She says, there was a teacher with two abuse charges, one pending and one settled, placed at Sherman Elementary here in San Francisco. Where was the evaluation process here? She was taken out of Bret Hart in Bayview and placed in West Portal, then dropped in fifth grade class. How could a teacher who is evaluated be given the second and third chances? And Jill Tucker, I know you know about that case.
Yes, that happened actually just this week. It was a situation where a teacher had accusations against her from a few years back that she had physically harmed students. Ultimately, there was no conviction. She wasn't prosecuted. She did a pretrial diversion program, but prosecutors dropped those charges knowing that she would be back in the classroom. It's unclear what happened, but there are laws, just like for employees of any business or organization, you can't just be fired willy-nilly for your age or for, you know, accusations. You have to, for specifically teachers, it has to be very clear if you're going to fire a teacher, if you're going to dismiss a teacher. And so in this particular case, there was no grounds for removal, but it raises the big point of what ultimately this issue is about, is parents and other folks wanting their kids to have the best teacher possible. They don't want terrible teachers. I hear almost every day, every week, I get emails from parents saying, help us get rid of this teacher. This person is terrible. You hear everything from English teachers who don't know proper punctuation and grammar to teachers conducting mortgage businesses out of their classroom and handing their kids, you know, just worksheets while they do that at their desk. You know, terrible to bad to, you know, just not great. And I think the issue is, what they're talking about with AB 5 and the STOLE Act is identifying the best teachers, identifying the bad teachers, getting them some help. But ultimately, what a lot of parents want to know, and teachers as well, because they don't want bad teachers in their school. It makes them look bad. And how do you get rid of them? How do you, once you identify the teachers, which most parents can do, how do you get them out of there? And this case in San Francisco, while there were no grounds for removal, illustrates the fact that it can be very difficult to remove teachers, ones.
And taking that one step further, you hear a lot about teacher burnout. And so many of these quote unquote bad teachers maybe are just, they've been on the front lines too long. But Jill Wins and Gary Bravani both, I ask you, what is keeping burned out teachers from moving on? I understand there's some real financial ramifications with their pensions if they don't stick it out.
Well, I think one of the main things that we ought to remember when you said teachers, first of all, teachers' jobs are enormously difficult. And we have eroded the resources. Not only have they been, for instance, in this state, pretty much every teacher operating without a raise for years during the recession and the state inappropriately cutting education funding. But in addition to that, all the support resources have been eroded too. So the last couple of years, we've asked them to do their entire job, but to work fewer days and get paid for fewer days.
Right, and we know all that. We know all that, but what is the financial tie that keeps them from moving on? It's connected to their pension payout, isn't it?
I don't believe it's a financial tie. I actually think it's their commitment to the job. And I think that when you talk, we have all mentioned peer assistance and review. It's the assistance part that's really important. So teachers need support. And by the way, it isn't only teachers. They just have a hard job. Everyone needs continuing support to stay engaged, excited, and able to do their jobs day by day.
Sure.
And every other industry
profession
provides support for their employees.
Sure.
We are very find it difficult or impossible to do that. So if you really, and by the way, we invest a lot in teachers too. We do not want to get rid of them. It's not this bad teacher, good teacher. It's people who are dedicated to these difficult jobs, who are doing the most important work that we do, and who need help and support continuously to do it, as does every professional.
That's Jill Wins.
Let me follow up a little bit with that.
Okay, Gary Rabani.
I appreciate that being said. We lose approximately half of our teachers within the first 5 years of their working. So when we're talking about getting rid of bad teachers, I think the evidence would suggest that people who find themselves not a good fit in the classroom tend to leave on their own. But within that 50% who leave, we also know there are a lot of good teachers, and we ought to be focusing on what supports need to be put in place to make sure that those people stay. The California State University system estimates that California probably loses about $500 million to $750 million every year in teachers leaving the profession early without supports. So indeed, it's quite truthful to say we've got a problem keeping teachers, not getting rid of teachers.
And
then let me suggest this, too, that when there's an instance of teacher charges of misbehavior, every district by law has a public complaint procedure so that the public can come in and make their complaint. It's then required that the member of the public meet with the teachers and discuss what the issue is. However, if it's a charge of abuse of some kind, the law allows administration to remove teachers from the classroom immediately until an investigation occurs to find out whether or not the abuse actually occurred. But certainly we don't want to get into a situation where just anybody can stroll in off the street, make a charge against a teacher, and immediately that teacher is fired. That's why due process is so important.
Right. But nobody's answered my question yet about whether or not there is a tie, whether teachers, and I just don't know this, do teachers have to stay a certain amount of time to have access to their full pension?
Oh, absolutely.
So does that keep them in the game
it's
longer?
It's sort of in flux right now because, of course, the governor's and the assembly's, the legislature's moved to reform pensions. But currently, in order to what we would call qualify for a full pension, that would be 2% times your number of years of experience at 60 years of age. So in other words, you would retire with about, if you put in your full 30 years and were 60 years old, you'd get about 60% of your salary as your pension. So, you know, that has to be somebody's concern. You don't want people to be putting in, dedicating their entire lives to the classroom and then losing a key thing that's going to support them in their later years.
Sure. Let's go to Fred, who's calling us from Oakland. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the air. Can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. So I'm a parent, and it irks me that I hear some group called Students First, which is a nice-sounding name, pretending to speak on behalf of all parents that were outraged about how you can't get rid of bad teachers. I have one kid in the Berkeley Unified School District who has, by and large, had great teachers all the way through. There have been a couple of teachers that were not so good, and in fact, one of them was gotten rid of within a year of the time my son was in his classroom. So I don't see that the process doesn't work now. My understanding, having talked to attorney for a teacher's union, is that in 99% of the cases, he said, where a teacher should be dismissed for incompetence, but is not, it's because the administrator hasn't done his or her homework to work under the system. And this, I think, gets back to what Gary Ravani was saying, which is that due to underfunding, severe underfunding in California, where we have something like we're 46th in the nation in per pupil spending, we have far too few administrators to do their job. And I think that's, to me as a parent, underfunding is far more of a problem than being able to get rid of bad teachers and changing the system to
right.
do that.
And
you have you know, Students First, I wouldn't characterize as a grassroots organization. I think they're an AstroTurf organization.
Okay, well, that's your take on it. Are you a teacher?
I am. I'm a community college teacher, and thank goodness that we do not yet in the community colleges have something like No Child Left Behind imposed on us where we have to teach tests. That would truly wreck instruction for us, just as it has in K-12. But I do want to point out that this is, to me, this is a diversionary tactic. There's a national effort to demonize teachers that has been going on for several years now. It's backed by the Walton Foundation, the Eli Broad Foundation, and that's who funds Student First.
All right. Well, thanks for the input. Thanks so much. It sounds like, well, Jill Wins, it sounds like removing a teacher, even an identified bad teacher, can be onerous, and that might get in the way of an administrator wanting to do the right thing, but understaffed and having to go through certain procedures. It can be a bit much to take on. Is that true?
Well, I think that it is sometimes perceived as being extremely difficult. There are a number of practices and conditions that affect this, as it should be. I mean, it shouldn't be easy to remove a teacher. It should be taken as the extremely important, responsible job that it is. So it takes time. In our case, and I would hope in every case, as we try to offer whatever support we can, in our case through our PAR program. But people often get, sometimes it's perceived or people believe that maybe they're just not in the right school and we could move them someplace else, which means you have to start all over again with the evaluations. And that takes time, as we have referenced. So, you know, it's a complex process, let's put it that way.
Sure.
But I do not agree, as some people characterize it, that it's just impossible to do. It's not. It's as it should be. It is a complex and difficult thing to accomplish.
Jill Tucker, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I do want to say, too, it can take time. They do have to, if a teacher is going to oppose dismissal and the union is going to back that, and there are no grounds like abuse or something like that that would be automatic, it's just for incompetent teaching or something like that. It does take a long time. And we do have a turnover of principals in schools, and it can take longer than a year to go through the process of documenting. And so if you have a switch of principals, it can be very difficult to continue that process. I have heard if the union fights it and the teacher is going to fight it, it can. In the past, there have been districts where it can take 2 years and $200,000 in legal fees to do that. So what tends to happen is either they try to counsel the person out of the profession, or what often happens is they shift that person to another school or say, gee, why don't you go get a different job somewhere else? And they call it the dance of the lemons. And it's a very common phrase where a teacher kind of shifts around from school to school and is never really their performance is never really addressed either through counseling or assistance or by getting them out of the profession.
Well, and that's what it sounds like happened in this recent San Francisco case, even where it was abuse and you'd think it would be an automatic out, but there was a shift around.
Right. Well, in that particular case, there was no prosecution and no actual conviction. So there was no grounds. The district couldn't, even if they wanted to, fire the teacher on those grounds.
All right, back over to the phones. Pat is calling us from Sonoma. Hi, Pat. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm there. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. I hate to shift the conversation here, but I just wanted to point out about teacher evaluation based on test scores. And what nobody ever talks about is the fact that students are really not accountable for their test scores. They don't have to perform well on their test scores. And as a teacher, it breaks my heart to see all the work I've done all year long fall into a column of C's, you know, just bubbles of C's, and students going, yep, I tried. And that's all they do. It doesn't matter. Also, high-end students, high-achieving students are kind of burned out. They don't want to take that test. They don't have to take that test. But when they don't take the test, they get the very lowest score possible. So I could have some students that had done quite well, but they didn't take the test, so it looks like they utterly failed.
Boy, I hear you on that one. I've heard that directly about kids who go into some of the standardized testing with no impetus to do anything other than just fill in the bubbles in a design because that's entertaining and they don't feel any personal stake. So thanks for that. Thanks for that call. Also have a web comment from Mark in San Francisco. Says, if test scores are used as part of teacher evaluation, then students should take a standard test at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year. The comparative results should be used in the evaluation. Any comparison to a broad standard would be an evaluation of the system as a whole. This is a simplified comment, but to hold teachers solely accountable on one test at the end of the year compared to a nationwide standard is wrong and poor. And that's a great comment about how you're then just gauging one student against himself or herself for that 1 year's progress. Jill?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's really interesting because I do think that the caller talking about the test and whether students try, I think that there are difficulties in using standardized tests. I will say many districts, including Oakland and San Francisco right now, are using what they call benchmark testing. It's internal testing. They give these tests several times a year to students based on the standards that the teachers are supposed to be teaching. And they're using it to help the teacher if there's kids that aren't getting the information so that they do get it. So there may be options out there that aren't these state standardized official tests to use these benchmark testings or to use other things, because I think it, you know, most people want something objective that says, are the students learning? And how do we figure that out within the teacher evaluation process?
David in Palo Alto, can you join us very quickly? We're winding up here.
Yes, I work with a network called Accomplished California Teachers. We're a statewide teacher leadership network that has studied teacher evaluation. I'm also a part-time high school English teacher, and agree with everything about the problems with the tests. They really measure a small fraction of what we're responsible for teaching, and they do a poor job at that. And I think the most telling thing in the recent debate over AB 5 was that when it was proposed that we should only use tests that are valid and reliable, that the organizations lined up against AB 5 had a problem with that. And I think that's a strong indication that they're more interested in approaching this from a political point of view and labor politics, rather than really being interested in what would be backed by research.
All right. Well, David, it looks like you've got the last word on that one. So thanks for weighing in. Jill Wynn, I want to finish with you just in a few short seconds. What would your ideal way of evaluating teachers be?
Well, my ideal way would be that we sit down with our labor representatives, with teachers' unions and others, and with teachers, and talk to them about what would be the most useful and important way. I think one of the things that we have, in the last comment in particular, that I would want to say, and especially in relation to what Jill Tucker said a minute ago, is
very quickly,
remember that the purpose of assessment is to try to improve instruction, not to get people, or even to assess the performance of the instructor. And that's why it's hard to find an instrument that's valid in this. So you have to understand more about what the purpose is.
And that should be true of
the way we assess teachers.
And that wraps it up for this hour of Forum. Thanks so much to all of you for being with us. That was Jill Wynn. She's the president of the California School Board Association and with the San Francisco Board of Education. Also with us this hour was Eric Hines, vice president of the California Teachers Association, and Tim Melton, Students First, a bipartisan grassroots organization. Gary Ravani has joined us for the hour, as well as Jill Tucker with the San Francisco Chronicle. Forum's producers are Judy Campbell, Tina Lorberg, Irene Noguchi, and our online producer is Amanda Stupai. For Dave Iverson, I'm Penny Nelson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.